Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM and FM HD1. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1067, I will air a lecture I attended and recorded at the University of Houston held on February 9th, 2023, titled The Black Study of an Old Matter, The Poetic Societies of Africanité and Arabité, by R.A. Judy, Professor of Literature at the University of Pittsburgh. The lecture was organized by the Arab American Educational Foundation, Dr. Burhan and Mrs. Misako Ajuz, Professor of Arab Studies at the University of Houston, co-sponsored by the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies, the Department of English, and the Department of African American Studies at the University of Houston. In his lecture, Professor R.A. Judy considers the way in which the confluence of conceptual, performative, poetic practices of living with nothingness challenge the political foundations of the neoliberal world order. Let's listen in, and the voice you will hear first is that of Hussam Abul-Ala, Professor of English and the Arab American Educational Foundation, Dr. Burhan and Mrs. Misako Ajuz, Professor of Arab Studies at the University of Houston.
Thank you all for being here. It's great to see everyone tonight. I wanted to start off by thanking for their generous support the English Department, the AAEF, Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies, Burhan Misako Ajuz always, the Department of African American Studies, which generously supporting this event as well. For logistical support, my thanks to Rand Khalil and to Fadi Kafaiti, also to Professor Jihan Yüksel, who is invaluable, as well as our incomparable English department staff, Andre Cobb, Val Gonzalez, and Christian Melger. Rand Abdelrahman Judy is professor of literature at Pittsburgh University. He holds advanced degrees from Al-Azhar University, which many of you know is the oldest university in the world, I should note, and from the University of Minnesota. He is a member of the prestigious Boundary 2 editorial collective, and the author of a groundbreaking volume entitled Disforming the American Canon, The Vernacular of African Arabic American Slave Narrative, which was published in 1992, and more recently a monumental study of comparative and global black humanity entitled Sentient Flesh, Thinking in Disorder, Poesis in Black, published in 2020. And I was thinking the other day about how both these books come out at a particular time when there's a sort of assault happening on curriculum in the United States, and the way these, like with their academic, well, through all their academic rigor and attention to philosophical rigor as well, both these books intervene or speak to those issues very, very presciently and cogently. Surveying the essays that he has authored and the special numbers he has edited in between those two prodigious provocations reveals a scholar with an incomparable range. His work has addressed Kant's discourse on race, the writing of Naguib Mahfouz, the philosophy of Ibn Sina, Ralph Ellison, the Tunisian Revolution, W.E.B. Du Bois, Aimé Césaire, Hortense Spillers, and many more topics. In general, R.A. Judy's reputation precedes him, but as we have prepared for his visit, I have had a few occasions to try to summarize what does R.A. Judy do? So quite a challenge, either in print or in conversations. Each time I have realized how daunting a task this is when the question involves such a polymath. So rather than continue with this impossible attempt at a summary, let me instead offer two gestures by way of introduction. First, let me say on a note both professional and personal that as a literary scholar trained in the United States during a time when the United States was regularly engaging in war and invasion in the Arab region, that his meticulous scholarship appeared at a time when I was yearning for models of scholarship with deep knowledge of United States culture and a serious engagement with the language, ideas, and texts of the Arab world. This is one of the senses in which R.A. Judy's scholarship was an inspiration for me. No one else could write with authority about both El-Mutanebbi and James Baldwin. No one else dared to. Second, the extensive bibliography of R.A. Judy, of the R.A. Judy essay in general, is toward a particularly toward a particular end that I must emphasize. In a recent interview, he spoke of the disciplinary need that we, instead of, quote, viewing underexplored languages, Arabic, Parsi, Urdu, Chinese, and Kiswahili being examples, we take seriously theorizing about the issues at the heart of comparative literature that have taken place in those languages, end of quote. This gets at something foundational in all of Judy's provocations, the attempt to see humanity where culture has degraded it, in neglected world languages, in the lives of Muslims and slaves, and in the experience of subalterns of various types, and to expand our very conception of humanity as dynamic, fluid, and global. If scholarship will still matter for coming generations, we must embrace this spirit. Let us then begin doing so by welcoming Professor R.A. Judy to Houston.
Thank you, Hussam, for a very humbling introduction. I want to also thank all those who have worked very diligently with the logistics to bring me here. I want to thank the English department. I want to thank African-American. I want to thank history. And I want to thank the Arabic program. The coming together of all of those programs to invite me here speaks exactly to what I try to do in my thinking and my living. I hope I shall not disappoint. In the spirit of truthfulness in an era in which that is not always respected, I should point out that I did 4 years at Al-Azhar without taking an advanced degree. Right? In fact, I think most of my learning was كان في الزنقة. And also, for some reason, my Tunisian colleagues, and I've done a lot of work with Tunisia, insist on making me Abd Rahman. And that keeps circulating in print, right? They somehow associate me with Rahma or Allahu A'lam. But in fact, it is Ronald Abdul Muttalib. That's a particularly weird name, but that's another conversation we can talk about afterwards. So, the black study of an old problem, the poetic socialities of Africanité and Arabité. The title of my talk warrants some explanation and elaboration, beginning with its main clause. It is formulated in reference to a project I call poetic socialities. Well, that's really not quite right. Better to say a present figura issuing from a long-term project, the reference point of orientation for which is the question, who speaks and can speak the human, and how? This question has served as the guideline for a sustained inquiry, going back some decades rather, into the conditions of possibility for ways of human being, following the line of thinking indicated with Frantz Fanon's remarking in Black Skin, White Mask, that the Negro, le nègre, emerges when one metaphysics is abolished and another is imposed. What interests me here are the workings of what I think are, or think of as, cosmic hegemony, meaning the conditions and processes whereby a specific, any specific narrative that establishes and sustains the order of cosmic reality gets imposed as encompassing absolutely all being. In the passage I've just alluded to, Fanon refers to such cosmic reality as système de référence. He does so with an eye toward Sartre's being in nothingness, where it is used in translation of Heidegger's concept of Weigungsganzheit, referential totality. whereby the activity of signification constitutes the world and its worldliness. This is also what Charles Saunders Peirce called semiosis, the process of which he construed as isomorphic with thinking, and as such, a function of sociality. Succinctly put then, systems of reference, or semiosis, always indicate the world whereby human being exists and lives with relevance. The focus of poetic socialities is on how elements come into confluence in the semiosis of the world. This is very much a question of action. Accordingly, attending to the how of semiotic confluence inevitably entails attending broadly to the activity Aristotle termed mimesis. More narrowly, it involves attending to that particular sort of mimesis he called poesis, which, because it formally exhibits what it exposits, change over time, change in action over time, we can reasonably construe to connote human creating in semiosis. It is the species activity of actualizing in discrete material forms of signification any given collective conception of being in the world, in accordance with a specifiable set of practices of living. In my recently published book, Sentient Flesh, I have termed such semiotic confluence parasemiosis. To connote the confluence of multiple vectors of referential totality without synthesis. W.E.B. Du Bois described the flow of such multiple vectors as the 1,001 little actions which go to make up life, essential to any clear conception of the group life taken as a whole. Taking up his project of achieving a science of ethics as a serious point of departure for reimagining sociality, Sentient Flesh supplies an account of how those people defined by capitalist modernity as proprietary things called Negro, created and sustained in the interstices of that world order, discrete forms of parasemiotic poesis, indicative of multifarious sets of practices of living, which expressed ways of performing human being across generations. The question at hand is, what do these practices of living have in common? Or more precisely, كيف هم في الأمة? How are they in common? Here the term الأمة is taken to signify collective human being that is brought together in reciprocity on the basis of a fundamental and universal dignity, which is why I translate the term as community rather than nation. And in so doing, I depart at once from the generally received conceptual historiography of modern state formation, including its Islamicist application. Accordingly, the question of how these various practices of living in common gets inflected by a very concrete set of events called Athawr al-Arabiya, revolutions, which are punctuations of two strong tendencies towards sociality within the still unconcluded march of modernity. On the one hand, there is the tendency to transform nearly all modes of primarily, but not exclusively, human life into manageable forces of perpetual progress, the metric of which is ever-increasing accumulation and generation of wealth. At times, we identify this tendency with the long momentum of revolutionary bourgeois formation, its punctuating events being the Reformation, Enlightenment, and Industrial Revolutions, culminating in the revolutions of 1848, which left the liberal state formation a permanent feature of the political landscape. As a matter of political economic theory, we seem to have accepted now more than ever the proposition that the liberal bourgeois nation state is the most ideal formation for securing growth in wealth and collective well-being, the Commonwealth. At other times, we identify this same tendency towards hypermanagement with imperialist capitalist colonialism, as it subsumes and rearticulates millennia-long ways of human being, feeling and thinking into new, narrow ones in accordance with the logic of bourgeois formation, declaring this to be developmental modernization. The same tendency, however, also prompts vectors of performance of what I refer to as practices of living that aren't quite so readily subjugated to the economic or the political. This too is a tendency of modernity, one that is not as much a resistance or rejection of management as it is a dispute of style, and very frequently mostly about the distribution of wealth. It is when it is a dispute of style, however, that it is the most radical in punctuation, because with the questioning of the style of management comes invariably questions about the subject of management, questions about what we mean by the human. Such events tend to reverberate across space and time so that their local circumstances and local predicaments and the idiomatic procedures evolved to cope with those circumstances have worldwide implications and application. These have not been many in modernity, but what I have in mind besides the Tunisian Revolution are events like the Haitian and Algerian revolutions, and also what the Trinidadian thinker C.L.R. James referred to in the 1960s as the Negro Revolution. Coming back to the question of being in common, what those particular events are in common is African. The challenge is understanding how they are so and what that has to do with Black study. Framing the question in this way has to do with something else Fanon wrote in the Journal de Bord he kept on his journey south to Mali in 1959, published posthumously in 1964 by Maspero under the title Pour la Révolution Africaine. The trip was a reconnaissance mission for the FLN, part of the effort to externalize the Algerian Revolution by creating an African Legion and opening a southern front in the War of Independence. The pertinent passage occurs in the chapter, Cette Afrique à venir, the Africa to come, where after recounting in some detail the mission objective of establishing supply lines from Bamako to Algiers, Fanon writes, after carrying Algeria to the four corners of Africa, I should like to subdue the desert, deny it, assemble Africa to create the continent. Créer le continent. What does Fanon mean by créer le continent? The remark about having taken Algeria to the four corners of Africa is in reference to his official diplomatic mission as the representative of the provisional government of the Republic of Algeria in Accra, Ghana. The main purpose of that mission was to gain the support of the Afro-Asian bloc in the UN for the Algerian Revolution. For Fanon, this meant establishing in the imagination of the emerging leadership of the emerging, soon-to-be independent African states that the Algerian Revolution was an African revolution, that it was fully theirs in principle and ambition, that it was about the transformations of the myriad of former European colonies into a continental community. Africa. In a well-known and pivotal 1971 Revue Esprit essay entitled La vie impossible de Fanon, The Impossible Life of Fanon, Albert Memmi somewhat dismissively accounts for Fanon's conviction in the continental African revolution in terms of his desire to escape his negritude. Now, this is a perplexing observation, given Fanon's emphatic rejection of negritude. That is to say, his Africa was not a racially described continent. But then Memmi's observation says everything about the observer, about the distance from which he looks on, about his profound unfamiliarity with Fanon, the man, or his work. Assuming that by negritude means Fanon's blackness, what might we ask is the underlying presumption about blackness as a condition or state of being that one wants to or can escape? At issue is the nature of subject formation of the self. And Fanon's implicit phenomenology suggests it is materialist and intersubjective. This goes to the problematic of recognition and solidarity. In other words, Fanon calls us to struggle with achieving a new conceptualizations of ways of human being and to make that struggle the basis for working toward a truly inclusive world of social justice and freedom. That this struggle is to come out of Africa was for him a certain realizable possibility. Fanon's ability to become Algerian, although born and raised in Martinique, was not, as Mémy claims, a denial or escape from his blackness. He could become Algerian precisely because of his blackness, of his radical blackness. To get what I mean by this, I ask your indulgence as I recall how Cedric Robinson described the black radical tradition in 1983 as a specifically African response to an oppression emergent from the immediate determinants of European developments in the modern era and framed by orders of human exploitation woven into the interstices of European social life from the inception of Western civilization. I want to expound a bit on what I think the term African in this description designates. Robinson was not offering an essentialist description of blacks or Negroes as a racial category. It is rather a description rooted in the historical encounter between Europe and Africa, the generative processes that encounter having created different historical processes, not of commodification, but of what Fanon's fellow radical Martinique activist and thinker, Aimé Césaire, called chosification, thingification, which he equated with colonization. That process generated a new set of questions about the nature of human being, informing and informed by a plurality of life practices, from political organization and discourse to aesthetic and ethical formations, constituting a distinctive tradition of modern thought. One of the earliest discursive formulations in this tradition is the writings of Atuba Kuguano, whose 1787 Thoughts and Sentiments on the Evil and Wicked Traffic of the Slavery and Commerce of the Human Species was arguably the first slave narrative to explicitly call for absolute abolition of slavery worldwide, indicting it as a perverted economic and political order at the very foundations of European modernity. The basis of Kuguano's indictment is the inviolable rights of all human beings, which the existing political economy of modernity fundamentally violates. His including in evidence of that violation the parable of Pizarro's massacre of the Inca underscores the indissoluble connection between slavery and colonization in his critique. Something that was unusual for the time, I would say even now still, and indicative of the distinctive contours of the black radical tradition. Calling this tradition of thought black study is not to suggest pace mini, a racially defined tradition of thinking and acting, but rather, given the broad scope of Kuguano's critique, which focuses in tandem on two distinct non-European historical experiences of modernity as oppression, without losing perspective on their particularities. In that way, the phrase black study constitutes a tradition of critique of capitalist modernity that develops a dialectic of imperialism and liberation in a position, as in beside the material historical conditions of racialized oppression. in such a tradition of critique because it eschews the subject of anthropology, enshrined in Kant's figure of man, das Mensch. The subject of revolutionary change is neither bourgeoisie nor proletariat, but rather the dehumanized subject, the figure created by the historical force or forces of thingification, thereby striving to found a humanism that Césaire characterizes as made to the measure of the world. This is not a humanism of the West in which man and the self is a disappearing figure, but rather a force that drives toward what Fanon called doing something new. From this perspective, the term Africa signifies numerous things, all of them having to do with encounter, beginning with the Phoenician encounter with the Amazigh Afiri at the beginning of Carthage. Semper aliquid novi Africam adfere, writes Pliny the Elder. Africa always brings us something new. When he said that, he was quoting Aristotle, who was postulating the perpetual biological hybridization of African life forms. What makes this pertinent to my remarks here is it's indicating the antiquity of the northern association of Africa with the encounter of profoundly alien entities. The synthetic result implicit in Aristotle's original remarking notwithstanding. But, as Al-Jahd showed us in his Kitab al-Haywan, that synthesis, the book of the living, suffers from a defaillance, from a failure of imagination. My point with this last remark is that Africa designates what is emergent in the encounter with synthesis. For Fanon, bringing Algeria to the four corners of Africa and Africa back to African Algeria was a step towards engagement with the multiplicitous ways of human being that sheds the synthesizing tendencies enshrined in the figure man. By foregrounding that African being is perpetually being perpetually in between, on the way, or restless, على قلق, as the Tunisian writer Mahmoud al-Mis'adi put it, quoting a line from one of al-Mutanabbi's qasida that goes, على قلق كأن ريح تحتي أواجهها جنوب أو شمال. Restless, as if riding the wind, steering me south or north. Obviously, the point of this canonical Tunisian reference is to carry Fanon's account of the Algerian revolution as an African revolution over to Tunisia. And in that respect, to claim for it the same ambition of freeing the continent. This time from the dehumanizing forces of neoliberal capitalism, the reducing of living to questions of economic stability. Whether it succeeds or fails, the very effort at such freedom is in service of human being at large, because it plainly pronounces the perpetuation of possibility. For to give up possibility means totally succumbing to the atomization of neoliberal capitalism, succumbing to the premise that market value, the dynamics of high capitalist finance, are the absolute measure, not just of progress, but existence as well. This would make the economy of consumption and desire, desire and consumption, the only tenable norm of subjectivity in general.
You're listening to Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. What we are listening to is a lecture I attended and recorded at the University of Houston, held on February 9, 2023, titled The Black Study of an Old Matter, The Poetic Socialities of Africanité and Arabité by R.A. Judy, professor of literature at the University of Pittsburgh. The lecture was organized by the Arab American Educational Foundation, Dr. Burhan and Mrs. Misako Ajuz, Professor of Arab Studies at the University of Houston, co-sponsored by the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies, the Department of English, and the Department of African American Studies at the University of Houston. Let's continue listening to the rest of that lecture.
Now, what is remarkable about the events that unfolded in Tunisia, and the momentum of which may have been stalled by what is currently going on with Kais Saied, but not arrested. The media doesn't cover the fact that there's still rolling strikes. It doesn't cover the fact that the people are still pushing back, right? And not just in Tunisia, across the region. Is there historicity that they show, to paraphrase Alain Badiou, the capacity for creating new forms of collective organization is still with us, is still intact. Now, I draw attention here to this distinction between the processes of market-driven subjectivity and the capacity of the Tunisian revolution to create new forms of collectivity. In both instances, we are talking about some process of individuation that has the practical and very material function of socialization, of creating a certain type of individual suitable for a certain type of sociality. The individuation process of the neoliberal capitalist market may indeed engender the normative subjectivity of the market through its endless refashioning and managing of desire and imagination. But it also engenders something else that can be called an aesthetic sociology. An aesthetic sociology. The spontaneity of subjective feeling into volatile and unpredictable occasions of consensus. Such instantaneous sociality of the crowd is a counterstructure to the cumulative institutionalized practices of disciplining normality. From media advertising to the hypersecurity state, as well as the legislative rationality of cognitive space, or what we might rightly understand as the methodological practices of the human sciences in the university. All that is interrupted by the faceless agency of the crowd. And this interruption holds the promise of what Fanon referred to in his forward-looking analysis of the potential of the Algerian revolution, again, as doing something new, and which gets paraphrased often as neo-humanism, but which I prefer to call Black Study. Turning then to the second clause of my title, Africanité, Arabité, Africanité, and Arabité. This is a coincidental reference to the lecture given by Leopold Senghor at the University of Cairo on Thursday, February 16th, 1967, on the occasion of his being awarded an honorary doctorate by the president of the university in the presence of President Gamal Abdel Nasser. Chance that I should incorporate as the subtitle of my talk the title of a significant lecture given exactly 56 years and 7 days ago on the same day of the week. This is Thursday, no? Ah, yes. But not a chance to be missed. For it was in that lecture, given in the then capital of Arab nationalism, Cairo, Egypt, before the greatest political leader of the cause, that Senghor deployed the findings of ethnology and anthropology to identify the North African Arabs' Berber origins, and then to identify the Negro substratum of that origin. In fine, Senghor sought to determine the Africanness of the greater portion of the Arab world as a racial fact, in order that he could formulate an argument for the cultural continuity of Africa. Hence, Africanité indicates the fluid and complexly interconnected world of the affective consciousness of mind, Senghor elsewhere called Negro. Of course, the political expediency for Senger's argument was to establish a conceptual basis for the alliance of two political projects of African independence and Arab nationalism. This was, after all, the president of Senegal speaking to the president of Egypt. Predictably, that conceptual basis would be articulated in terms of cultural affinities. This was, after all, the principal ideologue of Negritude speaking to the principal ideologue of El Uruba. All that aside, what is pertinent about Singer's lecture to my talk today is the facile, indeed too facile, identification of racial definition with cultural and even linguistic identity. Once Senghor has determined the Africanness of the Arab, he proceeds to incorporate Arabic into our patrimony, into Africanité. From here, he launches into an imaginative, rather detailed comparative philological analysis of Tadmin, Qiyas, and Majaz, varieties of metaphoricity, whose aim is to establish through the identification of parallel linguistic structures that the African mind was predisposed to receiving Arabic, and by logical extension, Islam. The story is a very familiar one. We all know it. The description of the cultural world of the fluctuant, the affect of consciousness that is distinctive from the analytical consciousness of modernity. What is of interest to me here now in this talk is something almost pedantic about that story. Almost pedantic, I say, but crucial. And that is the persistent preoccupation with the antiquity and phenomenon of Arabic in Africa. A phenomenon that clearly for Senghor posed a critical problematic to the project of racialist cultural identity. His initial formulation of Negritude, formulated during the post-World War II struggle for independence, turned on a radical dichotomy between putative traditional Black African culture and so-called Western civilization. With Senegal's independence in 1960, however, Senghor starts to reformulate Negritude, shifting from emphasizing the radical difference between African and Western cultures to regarding the potential processes of their complementarity. He referred to this process as métissage, or cultural crossbreeding, which he regarded as an evolutionary process that would eventually culminate in a universal civilization. Moreover, as Senegal's first post-colonial president, he discovers he cannot define Africa without encountering Arabic. But the very nature of that encounter challenges, if not outright precludes, a racialist identity that has any logical coherence. Finding himself responsive to Fanon's insistence that the Algerian War of Independence was a paradigmatic African struggle, Senghor starts to redefine African culture not as homogeneously Black, but rather as an example par excellence of métissage, blending Black and Arabo-Berber heritages. By 1961, he starts to use the term Africanité to designate this métissage. His 1967 University of Cairo speech was the first public articulation and elaboration of this idea as the cultural basis for an envisioned African unity. As he tells Mohamed Azizi in a 1969 interview, the Arabs are conscious of their Arabité, and the Black Africans, Negro-Africain, their Negritude. Not at the level of their politicians, but certainly at the level of their writers and artists. What remains to be done is to convince the latter, the writers and artists, but more importantly, the politicians, that reciprocal cultural enrichment is the sine qua non at the base of Arab and Black cooperation. Saying her sense of culture and its articulations in literature and art here is revolutionary. Generatively transforming existing relations between ways of human being. This is métissage as creative force, or more precisely as poesis. Indeed, the title of Aziza's interview with Senghor is La Poésie de l'Action, the poetry of action. Had I the time and the inclination to further tax your already generous patience, I would elaborate on how Senghor's concept of métissage, with its focus on the Sahel-Sahara, still plays a significant role in current debates about the question of blackness in the region. In that same vein, I would offer a careful account of how that concept is a constitutive aspect of Arabic culture, giving in evidence El-Jahiz's aforementioned work, Kitab al-Hiwan, the Book of the Living, in which El-Hujinah, hybridity, and El-Muraqab, composite mixture, and Mutalaqiyat, interstitial diversity or confluence, that do not readily subsume into any one universal class other than that of the living, are a through line of the book. In fact, the principal investment of Kitab al-Haywan is in expositing the perennial dynamics of mixture as the energia of the living. When reading it, we are immersed in tales of mongrels and mutts. Significantly, El-Jahiz disputes Aristotle's theory of hybridization. More exactly, he disputes his postulate that once engendered, species are morphologically immutable, and maintains, on the contrary, that all zoological life, including human, is fundamentally transmutational. Al-Misr. As noted earlier, the principal problem El-Jahiz has with Aristotle's postulate of immutability is that his illustrations are lacking in imagination and far from any experiential knowledge. They lack, as he puts it, any empirical verification, any tajriba. Now, Al-Jahiz puts great stock in tajriba, which he uses as a specialized term of knowledge denoting experimental empirical knowledge, or ikhtibar. He also makes use of its more colloquial connotation as practical experience in the general sense of how one lives life cunningly. In both the specialized and the more general sense, a formal corollary of tajriba is ibda, commonly translated as innovation, but more aptly rendered as creativity or poesis. In the sense of fundamental transformative activity, the activity of giving coherent expression in transmutational forms. In this sense, we can say tajriba is about poetic transformations, which is by definition experimental form. As I say, time does not permit me to provide the careful account these things warrant. What it does allow me to do is simply remark both the resonance between Senghor's and El-Jahiz's respective theories of métissage, as well as their continued pertinence, thereby drawing attention to a history of ideas that is itself performatively métissage. We return then to the notion of parasemiotic poesis and the project of poetic sociologies. Poetic sociologies attends to the nature of the aesthetics entailed in such poetically expressed spontaneous popular consensus. Aesthetics here is expressly meant in Kant's sense of the system of a priori forms determining what presents itself to sense experience, which Jacques Rancière interrogates as being about the experience of a common world, or as he puts it, le partage de sensible, the distribution of the sensible. At the core of politics, now along these lines, the poesis of métissage, which I call parasemiosis, expresses the possibility of community. Poetry engenders a community of senses, an aesthetic community, what Zygmunt Bauman calls aesthetic sociality, and then describes as the spontaneity of subjective feeling into volatile and unpredictable occasions of consensus. The way this description resonates with ethnographic descriptions of spirit possession among so-called displaced African peoples is germane to poetic socialities and will be made clear at the end of my talk. For now, I want to point out that the contention of poetic socialities, is the spontaneity with which poetry expresses the possibility of community, instantiates a rupture in the order of things at the foundations of politics. Accordingly, such poetic socialities are performative of critique. Critique in this sense, not so much a reflective theory that gives agents a kind of knowledge of enlightenment and emancipation, which is often associated with the epistemological as well as sociopolitical movements of the so-called Enlightenment and its revolutions. Rather, critique is the activity of bringing the conceptual order of things to a critical point in the classical Greek sense of krisis, so that the possibility of a different dispensation is made evident. The crucial distinction between this and the Enlightenment-based concept of critique is that whereas the latter is predicated on the bounded reasoning self, whereby the activity of emancipatory knowledge is irreducibly the property of the self, the critique of poetic socialities is articulated collectively in the performance of being in common. Again, in the classical vein, this is a discursive activity, the activity of saying possibility, which is the phrase Aristotle uses to describe what he called poesis, taken to mean the species activity of making things, the actualizing in discrete material forms of signification, any given collective conception of being on earth. At stake in the conception of poetic sociality is an effort to think about modes of sociality that are not predicated on the self. Now, unquestionably, this is a call for renewed critical theory. It must be understood, however, that this criticism is not the performance of that which seeks to merely become something in terms of the current conceptual as well as political order of the world. Rather, it seeks to think with the movements of poetic socialities engaged in the world's disordering. It is a thinking in disorder. This has to do with contemplating how poesis animates creative imagining in a way that engenders a spontaneous affective community made aware of its constitutive engagement with the order of sensible things. To give you some sense of what is at play in this contemplation, I point out that the phrase poetic socialities is a rift in translation, on synoptic translation actually, on the term the 11th century CE Islamic peripatetic philosopher Ibn Sina used for such being in common with others in poetic energia. And that phrase is al-umma al-shi'ariya, the poetic or aesthetic community. The work of poetic sociality is focused on the critical comparative study of a variety of instances of contemporary umat shi'ariya, of contemporary aesthetic communities. of the formal practices and techne, the conceptual orientation and apparatus attending those practices, of a variety of traditions of musical healing rituals in the Arabic world associated with dispersed populations that have come to be designated as black. A definitively modern element in the construal of these populations as black is their supposedly being constitutively non-autochthonous to the spaces they inhabit, having been transported there under duress as capital commodities, slaves. Some instances of such that I am concerned with are the Gnawa of Morocco, the Stambali of Tunisia, the Diwan of Algeria, the Sambani of Libya, as well as the Suri of Oman. Elaborating how these practices are poetic socialities are iterations of parasemiosis, furthers regarding blackness as a critical orientation rather than an ethnicity or cultural identity, or even as something situated predominantly in a particular geographical region, say the North Atlantic. Indeed, it suggests that the political economic aspects and effects of the North Atlantic triangular trade had worldwide reverberations. Hence the resonance between these traditions and those in the Americas is more than just skin deep. Some of those resonant aspects are of particular concern in poetic socialities. They are engaged as specifiable traditions of ritual practice in the context of modern capitalist slavery and are inextricably associated with enslaved peoples taken largely from sub-Saharan Africa. They all entail a cosmology of parallelism between the Mluk and the Taq in Morocco, and the Awliya, who are Abiyad, and the Salhin, who are Kahul in Tunisia, in which there is a dissonant harmony of the material and spiritual realms. That dissonant harmony is dialectic, in that the forces of each realm are analogous to and have real effect on the other. The human person is in the balance of this dissonant harmony. And when balance is lost, when dissonance exceeds harmony, spiritual forces may become embodied in an individual, manifesting the dissonance as physiological and psychological pathology. In each of these traditions, it is the ritual performance of music using sanctified instruments that reestablishes harmony. Also in each of these traditions of musical healing rituals, the spiritual realm entails elements reflecting both Islamic as well as pagan sub-Saharan African aspects. So too, the sanctified music comprises Arabic and African forms and instruments. Accordingly, each of these traditions are distinctly localized. A notable thing about each of these populations is that their poetic performances, the parasemiosis of which is usually marked as formal hybridity, are regarded as fundamental to the collective national culture. For example, Suri is officially designated as Musiki Oman al-Taqlidiyya, traditional Oman music. Much in the same way the blues and jazz are considered the original American music. Iterations of this same tendency occur with the rumba of Cuba and samba of Brazil, as well as the stombali of Tunisia. Contra the culturalism of this tendency, whereby these groups' blackness is specified as a function of cultural performance abstracted from the material and political economic conditions determining their social status, poetic sociology regards these poetic performances as displays of how each of these peoples perform ways of being in common on the earth, in appositional relation to the specificities of their national identity. Indeed, a common feature of their respective poetic socialities is that they somehow trouble both the imperial colonial conceptions of polity, legitimated by conquest or possession through settlement, and the post-colonial conception of indigeneity as the most supreme claim to natural sovereignty. It is in this respect that the resonance between Bauman's description of aesthetic sociality and the ethnographic descriptions of spiritual possession is germane. For it is in this respect that these practices are formal performative critique of the naturalization of the self as the foundation of the social. The aim in the comparative study of such poetic socialities is not merely to show there are alternative archives of knowledge, but that careful engagement with these archives calls for a different way of thinking in terms of parasemiosis as an intellectual practice. In other words, the study of poetic socialities is committed to reimagining the field of humanities as a crucial aspect of social well-being. Justice, karma, dignity, and individual rights, the expressed agenda of what the Tunisians often refer to as Thawrat al-Karama, revolution of dignity across the planet. Thank you.
What you just heard was a lecture I attended and recorded at the University of Houston, held on February 9th, 2023, titled The Black Study of an Old Matter, The Poetic Socialities of Africanité and Arabité by R.A. Judy, Professor of Literature at the University of Pittsburgh. The lecture was organized by the Arab American Educational Foundation, Dr. Burhan and Mrs. Misako Ajouz, Professor of Arab Studies at the University of Houston, co-sponsored by the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies, the Department of English, and the Department of African American Studies at the University of Houston. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.